Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument in the combined causes of T.S. Stone Liberty Land Associates and Tommy Stone versus Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation and Mac Larson Trustee versus FDIC Manager Fund, successor in interest of American Savings Bank. Justice Doggett is not sitting for oral arguments. These tapes of the arguments will be made available to him should he desire to listen to them, and a decision as to whether or not Justice Doggett will sit in either or both of these cases will be made prior to the time that the court announces any judgment herein. The court is now ready to hear from petitioners in these cases.
Mr. Charles W. Cunningham and Mr. Mark G. Powell will present arguments for petitioners. Mr. Cunningham will open.
Thank you. May I please support? To suggest that the cases before you today are significant to Texas jurisprudence is to state the obvious. For the first time in Texas history, admittedly errorless judgments were reversed on appeal in direct violation of Rule 52A of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure. For the first time in Texas history, cases were reversed to permit the assertion of defenses that did not exist when the cases were tried and with respect to which no error was preserved. For the first time in Texas history, evidence properly admitted at the time of trial has been retroactively deemed inadmissible. And the Court of Appeals below, in framing its holding, said exactly that, and I quote, "The appointment of Fislick as receiver caused all evidence introduced at trials of matters extraneous to banking records to have been erroneously admitted as a matter of federal law." That quote by itself illustrates what a marked, unprecedented departure from Texas law the decisions represent. Simply put, the trial courts below did not err. Because the trial courts did not err, a century of Texas jurisprudence, not to mention three Federal Circuit opinions directly on point, precludes reversal of the judgment.
As dramatic, perhaps, or as bizarre as what your bottom line is, isn't this the result mandated by Congress?
No, sir, it is not. It is not because Congress did not intend to impart any new substantive rights. According to the court below, Fislick's special defenses, called the Dench defenses under Section 12, U.S.C. Section 1823, can be raised on the first time on appeal. Court and decision regulators can know about but never raise their defenses until the appellate process. Regulators, according to decision, unlike any other litigant, do not waive the defenses if they do not assert them in a timely fashion. And in contravention of the United States Supreme Court's decision in 1990 in Hallett v. Rose, which stated that states can apply their own neutral procedural rules to the assertion of federal claims, the court below holds that regulators can deliberately bypass Texas procedures required for the preservation of error.
Counsel, how do you reconcile the current opinion with the opinion in FSLIC versus Kennedy?
The current opinion cannot be reconciled with FSLIC versus Kennedy, which the court held there that Fislick steps into the shoes of a failed institution with no greater or lesser rights, so it is directly contrary to that decision. As Chief Justice Enoch wrote in his dissent in the case behind us, the F&A equipment leasing case, Stone fails to explain by what avenue a judgment is reversed when there is no error. There is no mechanism under our rules to permit a reversal when the judgment below was errorless. What happens, for example, when the defense is raised for the first time in this court, as the opinion below suggests that it might? What is even the name of the motion that is filed? And since the special defenses come into play only if evidence was admitted at trial, which was not reflected in the failed institution's official loan records, how does the Court of Appeals, or indeed this court, go about determining the contents of those loan records? Does it sit as a trier of fact, or does it simply reverse every case in which regulators intervene after judgment? In sum, there is no... I'm sorry.
Would you, regards timing, would you agree that if an institution became insolvent during the trial of a case and the FDIC was appointed as its receiver, that the FDIC could at that late hour raise Dench student defenses?
I don't know about during the trial. We would admit that before the trial it would.
That's not much of an admission. before the trial, is it?
No,
is
sir,
any party that comes in entitled to raise defenses before trial?
Yes, sir, there is.
During trial, you say no.
I had not thought about during trial. I would say no, that they could not, clearly not after judgment. Perhaps during trial, I would think it would raise some due process concerns.
If during the trial court's plenary jurisdiction a new trial was granted for whatever reason,
yes, sir,
the Dench Doom defenses would be permissible in the subsequent retrial case.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
If after trial and before judgment is rendered, the receiver should be appointed, can the defenses be raised then?
They cannot be raised unless they, no, they cannot. If they did not preserve them at the trial court level, that is correct. I asked the prior question because the court has plenary jurisdiction to grant a new trial for whatever reason.
So once your position is that certainly once the evidence closes, the instant defenses cannot be raised unless there's a new trial.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
And if you move the court for a new trial based upon the late entry of the FDIC into the case, and the necessity of asserting Dench Doom defenses, should that motion be granted or not?
I say the motion should not be granted. Yes, sir. In interpreting the
But surely that's within the discretion of the trial.
Yes, sir, it is.
Not something that we have to resolve.
That's correct.
If Congress did not intend to give the federal authorities any new substantive right beyond what they haven't come along with Dench Doom, why did it entitle that section Additional Rights and Duties?
Because it applies to FDIC as receiver. Clearly, what that statute does is say that the FDIC as receiver has the same appellate rights as FDIC corporate. And there's no question about that. It unifies the treatment of FDIC as receiver as FDIC corporate. What FERIA did in two steps is it unified that treatment that FDIC's receiver is given during the litigation process with that of FDIC corporate. It did two things. First, it made the Section 1823E Dench defenses, which codifies Dench defenses, applicable to FDIC as receiver. Before FERIA, the special defenses only applied under the statute to FDIC corporate. Second, and what's important here, it gave FDIC's receiver the same rights during appeal that FDIC corporate enjoys. In the section that the court below relied upon, 1821D13B, Congress simply provided that the rights of the receiver would be coextensive with those of corporate. But what the court below ignored and what is critical is that FDIC corporate was never had the right, and FERIA did not give it the right to assert the special defenses for the first time on appeal to vitiate a valid state court judgment. The section in question states, quote, the rights and remedies available to the that the FDIC as receiver has, quote, the rights and remedies available to the institution and the corporation in its corporate capacity, close quote, in the event of an appealable judgment. So the question arises, did the FDIC in its corporate capacity ever have the right to assert the special defenses for the first time on appeal?
Well,
the answer to that is no.
You're representing the Stone petitioner.
Yes, sir.
They didn't raise these defenses for the first time on appeal. They raised them in the trial court.
They raised them in an untimely motion, as indicated here. They raised them in an untimely motion for new trial.
But they did raise them while the trial court retained jurisdiction over the case.
That is correct.
Is there any authority which holds that those defenses cannot be raised at that point in the proceedings?
Yes, sir. There is the authority we cited in our brief, several decisions by the courts of appeal saying that it's simply that an untimely motion for new trial, if you just go on Texas procedural law, an untimely motion for new trial raises no grounds for reversal. Now, with respect to the applicability of the federal law issues, we think that the Olney and Thurman decisions, which talk about raising the defenses after a judgment, are clearly applicable to the court's question.
Olney was not raised, and Olney the defense was not raised until after the appeal was perfected.
That is correct.
But in Thurman, it was raised previously.
Yes, sir.
in the Fifth Circuit, however, has allowed the FDIC to go all the way through trial and not urge its instant defense until a Rule 60B motion filed after the judgment was entered.
Correct, and Justice Higginbotham and Thurman reviewed that decision, said it was a close opinion, distinguished that case because the regulators were parties to the case below, and said that in the case of when the parties below were the private parties, that there was little to justify upsetting the judgment, and distinguished the Castle opinion.
What does the sentence mean in Judge Higginbotham's opinion that it wouldn't make much difference anyway?
That the defenses, if that the parties to trial couldn't have asserted those defenses because they did not have those defenses, is what I think Justice Higginbotham meant by that. There is no doubt, and we don't contest, that Section 1821D13B gives FDIC as receiver the same rights on appeal as those accorded to FDIC corporate. But nothing in FERIA or in any other statute gives FDIC corporate the right to intervene after judgment and assert those special defenses. Dench was decided in 1942. Section 1823E was enacted in 1950. No case in that 40-year history until this one has even hinted that regulators can intervene and overturn an erroneous judgment. It would have been easy for Congress to have provided that the Section 1823E ditch defenses were applicable on appeal. It did not. And in making the appellate rights of FDIC's receiver coextensive with those of FDIC corporate, it did not give the FDIC's receiver any new substantive rights. Now, as Justice Enoch notes, the decision does run headlong into a conclusion contrary to established case law, both state and federal, to use his language. It conflicts with the holding in Fislick versus Kennedy by the Houston Court of Appeals. It conflicts with the Tenth Circuit opinion in Grubb. It conflicts with the two post-FERIA decisions by the Fifth Circuit, which are directly on point. The Olney decision, which dealt with the very same argument that Fislick is advancing here regarding 1821D13B, and it reviewed the provision and found that the provision gives Fislick no new substantive rights in the appeal. It was simply intended to clarify that the FDIC's receiver has the same appellate rights as FDIC corporate. As the court mentioned, the Thurman decision was a month after Olney. It reaffirmed that regulators cannot intervene after judgment of certain new defenses to reverse a case. And the court stated, quote, where Fislick is a post-judgment intervener and the newly proffered defense would not have changed the outcome of the case as it was tried, there is little to justify upsetting the judgment. Importantly, to the Stone case, Justice Higginbotham added that his decision created a disincentive for regulators to gamble on a verdict while holding a Dench trump card. Here, that is applicable because the regulators had the opportunity to assert a timely motion for new trial.
Why would you gamble if you were holding Dench doing the defense? What is there to be gained by the gamble?
I guess conversely, there's nothing to lose if they want to gamble on the merits.
There's no reason to gamble.
I'm not sure why the regulators, for example, did not file a timely motion for new trial after they took over Sunbelt and they had an opportunity to do so. They chose not to file a motion for new trial. So in this case, there was a procedural vehicle at least to raise the issue.
Does the record reflect that they chose it or that when they became receiver 18 days after judgment, there just wasn't enough time to get it done?
The record does not reflect that they chose it. You're correct.
The brief says they chose it, but there's no evidence of that in the record.
There is no evidence of that in the record. Following the Olney and Thurman decision, United States District Judge McBride in the Norglass opinion that we cited in our supplemental brief to the court criticized the decisions below as being largely devoid of sound reasoning. In a letter brief recently, respondents have cited the Fifth Circuit's short procurement decision in the Union Federal Bank versus Minyard case as being authority that you could raise it, the defense's post-judgment. That case is readily distinguishable because there the judgment of the trial court was in favor of the institution. Judicial economy would require that the special defenses be considered on appeal, because even if the borrower who lost the trial was successful upon appeal and secured a remand of the case, the defenses would be applicable at the new trial, which we readily admit. So there, the trial court is, in the interest of judicial economy and searching for ways to affirm the judgment of the trial court, did what it did. Importantly, the court in that procuring decision did not allow the special defenses to be asserted on, to overturn an error-free judgment, as is attempted here and was as was rejected in Olney, Thurman, and Grubb.
Well, again, we don't know that this is an error-free judgment yet.
Right. I think the court has to assume that for purposes.
There's still 43 points of error pending.
Yes, sir. That's exactly right. For purposes of this, I think the court must assume that it's an error-free judgment. There is no reason here to disagree with the federal precedent. The court below used a provision of federal law that federal courts say is inapplicable to overturn what must be assumed to be an error-free state court judgment. Instead of reading the provision in a manner that would not require abrogation of our state rules regarding preservation of error and leave the judgments intact, it gave a tortured reading to the provision to overturn an errorless judgment, direct violation of the rules of civil rules of procedure promulgated by this court. It in effect negates Rule 52A, which suggests that in order for a case to be reversed, that the litigant must preserve error at the trial court level. The court below opinion ignores principles of comity, which requires a sensitivity to the legitimate interests of both state and national governments. The federal courts have already determined that no federal interests require evisceration of state court judgments rendered before receivership. While there are no compelling federal interests at stake, Texas has a compelling interest to protect the efficacy of its judgments and the integrity of its rules of appellate procedure. It is quite clear that only when Congress clearly and unequivocally manifests an intent to preempt state law is this court required to ignore its rules regarding the preservation of error. And FERIA nowhere manifests that intention. The reading of the provision by the Fifth Circuit in Olney and Thurman, unlike the strained reading given by the court below, avoids undue interference with legitimate state interests, does not preempt state law, and avoids the serious constitutional issues that Justice Enoch pointed out in his dissent. I need to turn my discussion over now to the Larson court, to the Larson attorneys, unless there's questions that the court has for me.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mark Howe from Dallas for Mr. Larson as trustee. I sense that the court feels that the timing of the intervention by the federal authorities into the lawsuit it is an important item. And I note that the question from Justice Heck was, what about it before trial? What about during trial? What about in the gap before the rendition of the motion for new trial? And I suggest, and I forcefully suggest, that we have a very adequate statutory and procedural scheme in this state that I've been living with in my 16 years as a trial lawyer about when pleadings need to be filed 7 days prior to trial. We even have local rules in Dallas that used to change that rule a little bit before our new rules of civil procedure. And I don't see why the federal government should stand in any different position from any private litigant. Why, if my client has to have his pleadings on file 7 days before trial, why shouldn't they? And if there is a distinction, and I do not think there is, between Stone and Larson in this case, I suggest to the court that Larson's a lot harder. Because there's no question about motions for new trial, or in trial, or before trial in Larson. It is in the middle of the appellate process. In fact, it was at a time when the case was already fully briefed and set for submission. The case, if it had been not postponed, the oral argument, would in fact have been decided before FERIA was even passed.
The FDIC already stands in a different posture than the private litigant by virtue of the independent stand itself.
Well, I concur, Your Honor. And
do you agree that Congress or the Supreme Court in construing statutes could make the Dench Doom defense raisable at any point in the process, including on appeal?
I do not think so on constitutional grounds, but I'm on a theoretical basis, ignoring the constitutional aspects of it. Yes, sir, I think that we live with preemption, but I don't think that's what they did. I think it is just as Mr. Cunningham stated, that they are merely trying to codify what rights these parties had in the first place. Dench was basically federal common law. We've got a real interesting amicus that someone filed that goes through the entire chain of the evolution of Dench from its actual rendition and the creation of the original statute and things like that. And I think the amicus makes a compelling argument for showing this court that FERIA, as it was enacted in 1989, is a complete statutory scheme, and it doesn't add to the federal common law as it exists under Dench. It replaces it. And in my case, opposing counsel makes this equitable argument on behalf of the federal government about the savings and loan crisis and everything, and says that you should basically give a loose reading to this statute, which is basically reversing, as Mr. Cunningham said, an error-free judgment in my case. I believe my case will stand the insufficiency and no evidence points that have been thrown against it. And I don't think that that's the proper reading of the statute. The statute should give them what they're entitled to, the right to appeal, standing to appeal. But, you know, their institution that they took over chose the Texas state courts to litigate in. And in this case, I think it's important. In Larson, I think an important distinction is
the institution they took over chose the Texas courts to litigate in.
Yes, sir. Well, for example, American Savings Bank in the Larson case, Justice Heck, was an intervener. No one sued them initially. They invited themselves to the party. And an interesting point comes up as a result of that, because of the fact that the statute very clearly talks about that the jurisdictional event under FERIA is the acquisition of an asset, an acquired asset under the statute. And in Larson, the supersedious bond, which is now sitting down in the district clerk's office in Dallas County, was actually paid into the registration of the court not only before the FDIC or the FISLIC had anything to do with American Savings, but it was paid into the registry of the court before American Savings was even a party to the litigation by intervention. And to suggest that this supersedious bond, and of course Grubb and Olney make an important point that a supersedious bond is not an asset of the receiver or the FDIC in its corporate capacity. It is not once it's made into supersedious. Both these cases have supersedious. There is an argument, of course, because of the fact that the supersedious in Stone was made later, but in my case, there's no question that money was in the registry of the court as a bond around a less pendants for years before this case was decided, before FERIA, and even before American Savings came into the case.
Are there any constitutional implications for the result reached by the court?
I think there are vast constitutional implications.
Have those points been brought forward to this court?
I think that the answer is I don't know. In Stone, I'm sure they have. I don't think they were squarely brought in the Larson case, but I think they are squarely addressed by Chief Justice Heck in his dissenting opinion in F&A. He clearly addresses the constitutional problems where basically, as he puts it, we're reversing error-free judgments.
You mean Justice Enum?
I'm sorry.
They look alike.
Well, they're both from Dallas, is it? I think that obviously everything else that Mr. Cunningham has stated with regard to their point of error applies to the point of error number two before the court. I think it's important to understand that the Larson case is different because of the timing of the things, number one, but more importantly, that there is in fact a classic what we'll call a receivership here. They're FISLIC closed Sunbelt Savings. FISLIC didn't close American Savings Bank. No receiver, no nothing. And I think it's a critical distinction. The only evidence, you understand, we have no power of discovery. You know, evidence should be retroactively not allowed in evidence. Where is the power of my client to engage in discovery to determine if documents are covered by Dench, not covered by Dench? No, we didn't have any of these powers before the trial court. And we stand here before this court on one of our points of error about whether it's the intervention right.
you know, who owns the right to the supersedious money? In my case, it's in the Dallas District Clerk's office. It's an interesting question. I got to call. This court finds itself in a fact-finding position. Just as Mr. Cunningham said, what do you call the motion when somebody intervenes before this court and says, we want to raise dents for the first time? Well, the Court of Appeals finds itself in the same position, and they rely upon opposing counsel's affidavit, quote, based on information and belief. That's not an affidavit as I read this court's decisions. And under Rule 19, it should have been an affidavit or other evidence, but the only evidence is on information and belief. American Savings Bank assisted in the merger into Citizens Federal. And like I said in my reply in amended application, we've had contact with attorneys for Citizens Federal as late as a month ago saying, what's going on with their money? I'm going, what do you mean your money? I thought it was their money. We have not had an opportunity to even explore the basic point of who owns this cause of action. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please report? Mr. Charles R. Hayward and Mr. W. Ralph Canada will present argument for respondents. Mr. Hayward.
How does it feel to represent the 1,000 pound gorilla?
Well, we don't argue with them too much, Your Honor. My name is Charles Hayward. May it please the court, I will address the same point that Mr. Cunningham did on behalf of the petitioners. Mr. Canada will address the other two points on behalf of on the Larson case. Ms. Cortell, Nina Cortell from Haynes Boone, represents Sunbelt Service. And we also have Mr. Richard J. Osterman, the counsel of the FDIC here from Washington today. Petitioner's entire case in this court rests on a single premise, that the national policy of Dench Dimey in 1823E of the Federal Deposit Insurance Act, which protect the American taxpayer from claims not documented in the official records of a financial institution, can be frustrated by the fortuitous timing of the entry of a final judgment and the failure of a financial institution.
When is the last point in the judicial process where the Dench Dimey defense can be raised?
Motion for rehearing on the denial of application for writ of error or appeal in the Supreme Court of the United States, Your Honor, would be my reaction.
Is there any case that's gone that far?
No, sir. I think this may be the leading case in this area at the moment, both in terms of the correct analysis of the Dallas Court of Appeals and in terms of the timing of it.
It's a ton-pound gorilla.
I'm sorry?
It's not a 1,000-pound gorilla. From your point of view, it's a ton.
No, sir, I don't believe that's true, Your Honor. There are some alarmist statements in the application for the writ of error in this thing about thousands of cases being affected. We don't think that's true. Frankly, this is a very unique situation presented by these two cases that happen to have arrived at this court at approximately the same time. There are thousands of cases out there that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is trying to deal with. There is no doubt about that. There are probably no more than 5 to 10 cases, though, that will present the very unique timing situation that is presented by the Larson and the Stone case. There are simply not going to be thousands of cases in which judgments of trial courts will be overturned because of the application of the Dench-Dimey doctrine, either after judgment or on appeal.
Doesn't the state have a compelling interest in the finality of the judgments of its courts?
I believe that the state has a compelling interest in arriving at the correct result, Your Honor. I don't think there is any compelling result of interest in the state in simply having judgments affirmed regardless of the state of the law when the case is being reviewed.
Regardless of whether those issues were actually tried.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And how can you speculate at the number of cases affected when, according to your contention, the Dench-Dimey defense can be raised at any time, even in the Supreme Court of the United States on motion for rehearing?
Well, obviously, both sides are speculating a little bit, Your Honor. It's just that I think the FDIC has a little better handle on what the situation is in terms of the potential for raising Dench Deme post-judgment or on appeal, and how many cases would we have that situation in? And quite frankly, it's our reaction that it is not a major problem. There are not those many cases. How many cases are we going to have where the Dench Deme doctrine or its equivalent was not raised at the trial court, and there's a final judgment entered against a failed institution, and between that time and the time of the decision of the court on review or on motion for a new trial, the institution fails? The timing event here, I think, is what takes it out of the ordinary run-of-the-mill case. If the FDIC has the Dench Deme or 12 U.S.C. 1823E defenses available to them, in 99.9% of the time, they will be raised by summary judgment, and the case will be disposed of, and it will be over with.
Can you file a bill of review on a matter that where the judge becomes final asserting Dench Deme?
I had thought about a bill of review in state court, Your Honor, as one way that that might be raised, and I had thought about mentioning that to this court as an example of a case, and I cite a case in my brief in this court where by bill of review a point was raised 50 years afterwards. We are not contending that this case, that the new statute and Dench Deme are any sort of roving federal bill of review that would keep these cases open for 50 years.
And so, so your answer is no?
That's correct.
You couldn't assert a bill of review?
I think you might be able to assert it under a bill of review as a matter of state law. I think what Congress did, though, in 1821 D13 was address these problems and told the FDIC exactly what to do. If 13A says, in the event of a final, unappealable judgment, the FDIC is to abide the judgment, and then...
Isn't the judgment final from the point of view of issue and claim preclusion?
Under Texas law, it is, Your Honor. That is true. The judgment could be used for issue or claim preclusion in another action once the judgment is entered. On the other hand, once a judgment that is used for race judicata purposes, either claim or issue preclusion in another judgment is reversed, then the second judgment is subject to reversal also by appropriate review. The federal courts have numerous post-judgment methods for that kind of review. The Texas state procedures are not as well developed or well defined, really, as that, but there are writs of error, there are bills of review, there are post judgment methods of securing review. That's a simple matter of fairness in the race judicata claim preclusion, issue preclusion area, that if the first judgment is overturned, the second judgment should be also, at least as to that kind of issue.
You're not arguing fairness in this context, are you?
Your Honor, it's certainly fair in the sense that Congress has said that it is. The determination has been made that for the protection of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation funds and the American taxpayer, that in this unusual event that we find ourselves in where the institution fails, while the judgment is still appealable, that the Dench Deme defenses that protects the fund against secret arrangements, against oral agreements, against unwritten promises such as are the whole basis of the Stone verdict below, the typical lender liability. We've got some written documents, but they don't mean anything because we had all these side agreements over here. I think Congress has made that determination in terms of what's fair and made the balance between the taxpayer and the individual.
But those policies are not served by allowing the FDIC to raise it for the first time on the field.
I believe they are, Your Honor, as long as
the FDIC came into Stone 18 days after judgment was signed, it knew what the lay of the land was.
It knew about the judgment, I believe, at least we found out about it sometime thereafter. You can assume that we became aware of this on Friday, August the 19th of 1988. On the other hand, Your Honor, I think that is a much, much too narrow a reading of the policies behind 1823E and the Dench Deme Doctrine. The Dench Deme Doctrine is not based on solely the FDIC becoming aware upon the failure of the institution that there had been a judgment in.
There are two policies cited. The avoidance of hidden agreements
and the encouragement of bank officials to be, I think the word is mature, in the performance of their duties. How are either one of those served by allowing the interest to be raised on appeal?
Certainly, the primary policy of Dunstemy in 1823E that we would point to the court is the one in the that is emphasized in the Langley versus FDIC decision in 1987 out of the Supreme Court, Justice Heck, and that is that you've got to go back to the very first examination of the financial institution by the FDIC that fails to uncover the secret, unrecorded agreements, the oral agreements that are barred by the Dunstemy in 1823E, because at that time, with awareness, unaware at that time, the FDIC cannot take the actions that it needs to in terms of additional regulation of the institution or closing the institution at that time. And so I think the court in Langley was quite explicit that that is a critical policy behind the Dunstemy doctrine, and one that barred the defense of the borrower in the Langley case, because even though the FDIC, at the time of the failure of the institution, clearly had been aware of the continuing litigation between the Langleys and the FDIC prior to closure.
You talk about part of this policy is for the protection of the taxpayer, but aren't the individuals who are suing, aren't they taxpayers also, and don't they have rights?
Certainly, Your Honor, and I'm not contending that they don't. I'm just saying that the Congress of the United States has made the balance. They have made the balance in 1823, 1821, D13A and B, when it made the distinction between final, unappealable judgments and appealable judgments, and what are the rights, duties, and remedies of the FDIC as receiver and the FDIC in its corporate capacity at that time.
Along those lines, would you compare for us the FDIC's authority in its corporate capacity prior to Perry and subsequent to Perry, and also as receiver prior to and subsequent to
Perry? Well, certainly upon the enactment of FIREA, Your Honor, and I don't pretend to be by any stretch of the imagination a complete expert on FIREA, but the powers of the FDIC as receiver under FIREA were expanded some. For example, the FDIC as receiver now may apply to a court for a 90-day stay of all proceedings.
In this case, why didn't it?
Well, FIREA was enacted after this case. At that time, we did not. At the time of the Stone judgment in 88, FIREA had not yet been enacted. So we did not have the right to the 90-day stay. I think the point I wanted to make about the 90-day stay, though, is that Congress has now made the determination for all courts, whether they be state or federal, that upon appointment of a receiver, it is a very tumultuous time, and that to expect the attorneys for the FDIC as receiver for a failed institution to immediately, August 19th is Friday, August 21 is Monday, to by August 31 for any set of attorneys for the FDIC to have a complete hold of the Stone litigation.
But you knew enough to file a motion. You knew enough to file two motions by then.
Your Honor, those were trial counsel for the failed institution that filed those motions.
Being paid for by the FSLIC, under the authority of the FSLIC.
I would imagine that is true, that there was some compensation made at that time, although there is no obligation at that time other than for attorneys to protect themselves, which they do.
I guess the point is, the other side argued a moment ago, is that 1821 D13B gave the FDIC no greater powers or authority as trustee than it had in its corporate capacity.
What 1821 D13B does is to, one, give the FDIC as receiver appellate rights, equating its powers as receiver and as the corporation. the point that we have problem with is that the petitioner cites no case, and the Court of Appeals for the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit cites to no case that shows that there were ever any distinction between the appellate rights of FDIC corporate and FDIC receiver. There's no case cited by petitioners, there's no case cited by the Fifth Circuit, and the FDIC assures me that they have researched, they have no case to tell this court about either pro or con on that point.
Well,
so this must have been
the Congress
else.
Made the distinction in this enactment, though.
Well, the distinction in this case,
I mean, they distinguished between conservator or receiver and corporate capacity.
That's true. Conservators, receivers, so corporate capacity, there are numerous other cases.
Why should they cite a case that makes a distinction when the statute does?
Right. But the statute clearly applies to me, Your Honor, as receiver. Rights and remedies of a conservator or receiver, there is no doubt that I am here as FDIC, as receiver for Sunbelt Savings Association.
The question is whether you have greater authority than you would in the corporate capacity.
What the statute does was to make all the rights and remedies available to corporate, which at one time, 1823E, before FIREA, did not apply by its explicit language to receiver. Those powers are now equated in 1821D13B. Also, 1823E, which is the must be a written agreement part of FIREA, now has been explicitly extended to give the protections of that statute to FDIC as receiver. Prior to FIREA, there was some controversy about whether the statute, 1823E, could be used by the receiver. That has now been cleared up by FIREA. Before FIREA, it was clear that the Dooms-Dumy Doctrine, which in many, many ways is broader than the protection of 1823E applied to the FDIC as receiver.
Counsel, if a customer comes into the bank and says, I want to borrow $10 million, the bank says, fine, the customer signs a promissory note, signs a deed of trust, and pledges property worth $10 million. And next week,
the bank... Does he sign a note for $10 million, Your Honor?
He signs a note for $10 million, okay?
Right.
And, which is not necessarily approved by the loan committee.
Right.
It's done because you got a senior vice president, and he signs, gives you a UCC document, gives you a deed of trust, you take your choice. You have $10 million worth of collateral, but the money isn't funded. And a week later, the bank is taken over by the FDIC or the FSLIC, either way. And he sues. And you come in and assert Dench Dooms. Isn't he wiped out? He never got anything out, but he's got to pay. He's lost his $10 million in collateral.
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that is the
result. Where is the equity and the fairness in that situation?
The fairness, Your Honor, is simply this. The law presumes, and this goes to the constitutional issue that was raised here, which I think is entirely bogus in this case. The federal courts have considered the constitutional contentions from time to time. There is not one. From the very minute that Tommy Stone and his companies began to deal with a federally insured savings and loan on no interest loans to try to build his real estate empire, he was on notice of the applicability of Dooms-Dumy versus FDIC and the provisions of 1823 that every agreement must be in writing. And if you don't get the money when you sign the note and the bank fails, between the bank customer and the deposit insurance fund funded by the taxpayers of the American citizens, the Congress of the United States has made the determination as the equities there, the loss falls on the depositor. Now, that doesn't mean that is his only remedy. He might have remedies against bank officers or others who led him into that.
No, that's a real fairy tale. Can you say that he can recover his money against
not
the bank
necessarily.
Office?
If we're talking about $10 million, it might be, Your Honor. I don't have $10 million, and I doubt that any member of this court does, but if we're talking about the day-to-day business of a bank, that's another matter. And we've got to set rules that do apply in all of these situations, whether it's $10 million or $10.
Isn't really the underlying rule of Dinch Doom that when they come in, they have the right to all the assets, but they have no liabilities whatsoever?
No, sir, that is not correct. In the typical purchase and assumption transaction, upon the appointment of the, at that time, the FSLIC, let's take Sunbelt, on August 19th of 1988, the Fislick as receiver became the owner of all the assets and the target of all the liabilities. Usually, on the same day, there are purchase and assumption transactions entered into and other financial arrangements made to keep the institution up and running. It is not liquidated. It is easier, more convenient for the, for example, in this case, Sunbelt Federal Savings Bank was set up the same day, and assistance agreements, acquisition agreements, other agreements were entered into between the FSLIC and the new institution.
Under federal law, by whom does the loan have to be, it has to be in writing, we can agree to that.
Yes,
by whom does it have to be approved?
By the official committee of the bank, and it has to be part of the bank records.
Okay, but you, will you not admit that loan officers individually, unless they pass a certain amount, have the authority to bind the bank without it ever going to a loan committee?
That's true,
which,
Your Honor.
By your very definition, says that every time you deal with an individual loan officer and you stay below a certain amount, that you're totally at risk.
There has to be an approval of that loan.
By the loan committee.
Recorded in the official records of the bank. If
but
it is not necessary.
That's not banking policy in the United States.
Well, certainly every loan officer has a lending limit. But within that lending limit, his authority must be documented. His approval of the loan must be documented. I don't think there's any doubt of that, Your Honor. That there must be some record of the bank that reflects the approval of the loan. It must be approval of the loan that must be documented. I don't think there's any doubt of that, Your Honor. That there must be some record of the bank that reflects the approval of the loan. It must be reflected in those records of the bank. Now, certainly the cases have allowed the official records of the bank in terms of its accounting records to show in some cases that a loan was repaid. And we have no quarrel with those cases. I'd like to defer to Mr. Canada, who is counsel for the FDIC in the Larson case, with our remaining time.
Any other questions? Thank you, Canada.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I am Ralph Canada. I represent the FDIC in the Larson case. I will be using the remaining of respondents' time to deal briefly with those issues not yet addressed by Mr. Hayworth, which are contained in the three points of error upon which RIP was granted in the Larson case. These are the four other reasons that Larson argues why Dinch and 1823E are inapplicable to the claims, and the question of the substitution of Fislick in the Court of Appeals. The first reason that Larson argues that Dinch and 1823 are inapplicable to this case is his contention that the FDIC as manager of the Fislick Resolution Fund does not have the power to utilize those defenses under FIREA. 1821D13 can be used by FDIC as either conservator or receiver. It's also applicable to FDIC corporate under 1823D3. It is the position of the FDIC that as a successor to the Fislick's interest in a failed savings and loan, it is entitled to use 1823D13, regardless that all of the Fislick's assets went into the Fislick Resolution Fund. Indeed, the Fislick Resolution Fund is simply one of several funds created by FIREA. Also includes the Bank Insurance Fund, the Savings Association Insurance Fund. Our position is that these are merely accounting mechanisms to protect the banks from being taxed for the cost of the S&L failures and vice versa, not indications of any separate capacity. There is no indication whatsoever in FIREA that the FDIC as manager of the fund doesn't have the rights commonly afforded the FDIC, and numerous cases have now, without any discussion, afforded FDIC those rights, and we cite those at footnote 4 of our brief. I would point out the Olney and Minyard cases also do not discuss this issue, But in the case of Minyard, give the FDIC the same rights, even though it's acting as manager of the fund. Moreover, we would point out that in FDIC versus Gillard, which is 740 F sub 428, Judge Fitzwater, in overruling a similar argument in another case, which was that the FDIC did not succeed the FSLIC as receiver, acknowledged that in some instances FERIA might not be a model of clarity, but pointed out that their argument would mean that all three FERIA receiverships were abolished. Judge Fitzwater refused to reach this anomalous result, as he calls it. Similarly, Larson's construction here would mean that the FDIC could not utilize the extensive powers Congress gave it FERIA when dealing with all pre-FERIA S&L failures, an equally anomalous result. In addition, there are, in fact, indications in the statute that the fund does have these rights. We point out that 1821A subsection D, which is that part of FERIA creating the Fiscal Resolution Fund, refers to litigation, quote, against the corporation with respect to the Fiscal Resolution Fund. Certainly unusual language if this is a separate capacity. We point out that in both the Gillard case, which I just mentioned, and in the Stone case, they utilize section 401F1 of FERIA to say that the fund has the same rights. And finally, we point out that the definition of receiver, as used in 1821D13, is not limited to an official receivership, but to a receiver, liquidating agent, conservator, commission, person, or other agency charged by law with the duty of winding up the affairs of a bank or savings association. In this particular case, American Savings Bank went through what's called a supervisory conversion merger in order to prevent its failure. It is our position that the FDIC, in trying to resolve the assets that it took out of American Savings Bank, is winding up the affairs of that savings association. And thus, even if manager fund is a separate capacity, which we don't agree with, it is a receiver under the statute and entitled to these rights. Finally, we point out there's no reason why the manager fund couldn't be afforded the common law protections of Dinsch, as they've been applied in the Castle and Minyard cases. Next, Mr. Howe argues that a receivership is required for the application of Dinsch in 1823. There is absolutely no requirement in Dinsch or any of the cases that a receivership be imposed, and we cited cases on that point in the brief. Second, the language of 1823E includes assets acquired by purchase, and therefore also doesn't require a receivership. Finally, since we are a receiver within the definition of the statute, we can use 1821D13. Mr. Howe next argues that the manager fund has no asset in this case. As the Court of Appeals found below, when it granted the motion for substitution, the FISLIC Resolution Fund has the right to the $510,000 sitting in the court upon final determination of this case. That is certainly an asset. We'd also point out that no asset is necessary for the assertion of Dinsch-Dunn and for the assertion of rights very similar to 1823E, which are found in 1821D9A of the statute. Finally, Mr. Howe points out or argues that Dinsch-Dunn does not apply to alter ego claims. We state the policy reasons in the brief why it does. I would also point out to the court that the Astrup versus Midwest federal case, which is cited in the Stone brief, specifically holds Dinsch to bar alter ego claims. Certainly the policy is the same whether alter ego claims are involved or some other type of claims. In looking at the books and records of American Savings Bank, no regulator could have understood that they were the obligor on notes from Mr. Larson to Broadmoor Villas. Indeed, Mr. Larson never had any direct dealings with American Savings Bank whatsoever. And thus, the regulators were as deceived as they were in the case of Dinsch-Dunn itself. Finally, he argues that we're not properly before this court because of the manner in which FISLIC was substituted into the case. It is our initial contention that in regards to that substitution, there was some evidence, and therefore this is not a matter within this court's jurisdiction. Second, we think the standard under Rule 19 was satisfied by the court. There was a motion to substitute filed, which was verified by counsel, although parts of it were on information and belief. It is our position that affidavit was sufficient under Rule 14 and alone constitutes sufficient evidence. But the circumstances under which that motion was filed. Also, gave the Court of Appeals the satisfactory evidence needed for it to have allowed the substitution. Initially, as you can see from the face of the motion to substitute, it was believed that Mr. Howell had agreed on behalf of his client, Larson, to the substitution. Only a week later, after the filing of the motion, after the motion had already been granted, did he first lodge an objection to the substitution. Second, and most importantly, Citizens Federal, the party for whom we substituted, did not oppose the motion. They were served with a copy of it. They were conferenced before the motion was filed. They never took any action to prevent the substitution, and the motion to substitute itself quite clearly lays out that there was a substitution, a conversion merger, and that the asset belonged to the FISLIC, to FSLIC Corporate at that point, later the FISLIC Resolution Fund. We think in the context in which the motion was filed, even if the motion alone were not sufficient, that there were facts under which the court could have found that the substitution was proper under Rule 19. Certainly there was satisfactory evidence. In any event, we would comment that there are cases now dealing with these types of substitution issues, and they point out the futility of the substitution because the case will go up and down the appellate process like a yo-yo. If there aren't any questions, we would simply ask, on behalf of the FISLIC Resolution Fund in the Larson case, that the Court of Appeals be affirmed either on its own reasoning or on the no evidence points raised. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
May I please report? Mr. W. J. Cronzer, Jr. will present the rebuttal for the petition.
May I please court? 5 minutes of that one. I think the court's getting happy with my 5 minute talk. I do want to say what these things, though. Judge Gonzalez is correct in referring to the FDIC and its group as thousand-pound gorillas. I had always thought that this court fell in the category of the 800-pound gorillas, but if they're 1,000-pound gorillas, this court is a 2,000-pound gorilla. Because the question is, and that's the issue upon which both writs were granted, and that is whether or not Ferreira enacted more than a year after the final judgment in this case, operated so as to give increased substantive rights to the FDIC that it did not otherwise have prior to that time. Now, that's what the Court of Appeals held it did. And that's the issue upon which you granted both the Larson and the Stone Ridge. I also would like to make this, at the time of this judgment, insofar as the Texas law is concerned, the Kennedy case was the only decision in Texas or elsewhere on that subject. It, as here, was a belated motion after the judgment. The first court held, or this court denying the writ, that's just too late. Because if it is not too late, Your Honors, not only have we stood the Texas appellate system on its head, you have now got a new form and species of fundamental error, which you've been trying to restrict for as long as I've been here. Why is it fundamental? I think that can be demonstrated by Judge Heck's question. Judge, the case you inquired about, in which the Fifth Circuit held that a motion filed in the so-called 60B period was timely, and even though it was pled earlier, was not actually urged until during the 60B period, is the Castle case, arising out of the First National Bank failure in Midland, and through that with the Eagle Properties problem. In that case, the guarantors claimed they only signed a 25% guarantee. That's all they agreed with Mr. Frazier to do in that case. The records of the bank, which were in evidence,
on that sole point show that there, and he testified before the court in Castle, that that was not so, that the way he wrote it in full, the guarantee, was the way it was. Now, the reason, when we say this is an errorless judgment, that's a little bit erroneous in this sense. We don't complain or contend that either the FDIC or the service company or any of these parts of the program can't assert the errors that relate to this judgment itself. And we have to go a step further. If the Dallas court, to which it should be referred according back to us, should be remanded for further consideration, holds we're wrong and grants a new trial, no question then the FDIC can urge its Dates defenses. Now, Castle lights the question very clear. In that case, the court held two things. It was timely under federal practice, and secondly, which I think is critical, it could be decided as a matter of law on the face of the record. That can't be the case here. There would have to be other evidence in this record before you could tell what those bank records show, even though their motions claim that. They're not under oath. They're not like newly discovered evidence proceedings. You just cannot. And the Court of Appeals doesn't say you can't. They merely say this is something the FDA can carry along in its rear pocket and spring anytime it wants. Now, I don't have any answer, Judge Heck, to your question of why wouldn't they do it anyway on their first opportunity.
In this connection, I do think Castle's important. The petitioners have not had an opportunity to respond to Indianapolis against Menger.
Well, let me say this. If that's a question, then I can continue. Menger is a per curiam decision, Judge. And it is a case relying solely on Castle for its definitive basis. It is significant to me, not only because it deals with an affirmative rather than a negative, but it's most significant to me that court made no mention of Ali or Thurman, its own precedent on the issue of belated motions. And I just don't think, regardless of whether you feel the Fifth Circuit has correctly decided on Ali and Thurman, and naturally we do, the question is, would Menger couldn't have gone off and just overruled it without some suggestion. But it is...
By the same token, you would hardly think that they would write an opinion on that area and not even mention it.
Well, because it's Castle. That's a Castle case. And it can be. It was decided as a single point. The record showed the foreclosure was not in the record. They could make the decision on the facts, Justice Heck. You can't do that in this case. And lastly, at least I'm no question. I guess I can't say more.
I have a question. Do you all, the side you represent, suggest that before the Dense Doom doctrine can be asserted, some evidence is necessary? And if so, what type of evidence do you suggest that they come forward with before they assert the Dense Doom doctrine?
But if you assume, Justice Gonzalez, that Dense Doom is still alive as a common law doctrine, which we don't, but that's not material or ultimately to this decision. We say it's now a statutory remedy that you have, particularly since Ferreira. I mean, they've encompassed this field. But even if Dense Doom is still applicable as a common law equitable consideration, we say that it cannot be asserted if it takes facts to prove. Just to send it back to the trial court as was done here and start saying, okay, let's start seeing what's in the records, what's not in the records of the failed institution. The two cases that Justice Heck, or both Menard and Castle, are cases in which that decision could be made on the basis of the record. And if this court holds that that can be done without there having been a comparison of further evidence on appeal, that's what I mean. That is pure fundamental error. That the Ferreira, a year and a half later, just gave, overlaid the state system, to even create unconstitutional procedural due process. We sure ought to have a hearing on that, just on the back, with the fact question. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
That concludes the business of the court for the day. The foregoing causes are all submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The motion for Marshall will please adjourn the court.
Oh yes. Now, 3 seconds.